This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, the Mike Winters Lawn and Garden Show from Wintergreen Nursery Landscaping and Florist. Here's the Commissioner of Dirt, Mike Winters, and the Mike Winters Lawn and Garden Show on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hello there, 406, 52 degrees it says, but it's...
I don't believe that.
I don't either.
I just came out of that parking lot. It's like 31 or something.
That little blustery wind out there.
Very blustery. Knocked me down three times before I got to the front door.
I noticed you're kind of wet there.
Yeah, I fell in a puddle too.
Yeah. There's a lot of them out there.
I know there are. Oh, good afternoon. How are everything out there other than the weather?
The weather and getting wet and blown away.
Well, I got a kind of a different show today. I'm going to tell a few stories here about...
I like those stories.
You like stories, huh? Well, I'll tell you a few. I got way too many stories. I could only fit them on six pages of notes there. But if you're listening and you want to interrupt the storytelling time with a question about your lawns, your gardens, your trees, your daffodils that aren't coming up yet, just give us a call at 673-4464. 673-4464. So any kind of question is fair game. And I was thinking about all the people that have had an impact on my gardening landscaping life, and I was reading a couple of articles here in a magazine, and I just wanted to relate some interesting things that I never even knew about. We tend to forget how long the art of landscaping beautiful gardens has really been around, but they've been around in ancient times, in biblical times. There are descriptions of gardens that were constructed by different kings throughout history, dating back really, 4,000 years, 4,000 years.
Wouldn't think.
The gardens of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, for instance.
True.
There was actually roses growing in the Hanging Gardens.
Right?
Yeah. I was reading some of the stuff.
Couldn't get rid of them then.
No. And I think they had olive trees, of course, and all that kind of stuff. And then in the medieval Europe... And in Chinese history, mankind built and tended huge gardens and landscapes. Mm. I was reading about some very large formal gardens that some of the sultans in the desert regions had built for their palace and all that. And it's an amazing amount of things that they did. And, where in the world they got the water in the desert to keep things, going, I have no clue, but they did.
Maybe we better find out their secret.
Yeah. But then I ran across this article about a man who designed and built Central Park in the middle of the island of Manhattan.
Was that Donald Trump?
No, it wasn't. Don was a baby back then. Who designed it and built Central Park, his name was Frederick Law Olmsted, and I never heard of him. And the year was 1858. That's when he began to landscape what is now Central Park.
Wow.
1858. Okay, think about this. There ain't no backhoes. There's no tractors. Mm-hmm. Cars haven't been invented yet.
No.
Maybe wooden wheelbarrows and shovels and things like that.
And horses, maybe.
And horses, yeah. But old Frederick, he was really interested in gardening and landscaping, and he was he won a competition to plan out the Great Park in Manhattan, and he became the chief architect. And he drew plans, and he redrew plans, and he walked. And the interesting thing, way back in that day, Central Park was 778 acres in size. But now, since it's been expanded to 843 acres.
It's grown.
And it's in the middle of a stinking city, man.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I was on the top of the Empire State Building looking not right down on it, but it's right there in your view. It's huge. When you get the aerial view, it's an amazing, amazing place.
It looks a lot bigger than it does on TV.
Oh,
it looks like a little
square. Exactly. And... that's a pretty big landscape job to design and build when there are no no machines and things like that. Where in the heck do you get the topsoil, for crying out loud? a buckboard with a horse, a couple of horses, you know, pulling two yards of topsoil or 5 yards of topsoil.
Very labor-intensive.
Right. Like I say, no trucks, no trenchers, you know, and he put a water system in there. Didn't say what type of water system it was, because I don't think sprinkler heads were invented back in 1858 either.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I doubt it. But if you've never been to New York or Manhattan and seen this, if you ever get the chance, it's an amazing thing. Or if you, I don't know if they got videos on it, visit Central Park through our video here or whatever. But anyway,
it's probably full of homeless people today.
Well, I don't know if they got many homeless living in Central Park. They might have a few, but it's kind of a wild place too. I mean, there's a forest there. Yeah. You know, it's not just like Stewart Park or something. You know, it's an amazing thing.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, with the wheelbarrows and lots of manpower, he got this thing built. And it was interesting. The main reason this site was chosen for a park was the ground was solid, impenetrable bedrock, and the builders couldn't break through it to build anymore because they were starting the skyscraper stuff back in those days. And they said they needed softer soil in which to sink the foundation pillars or, you know, whatever would support those large buildings. So they said, we don't want to do that. Make it a park instead. And so this guy took this rocky, not all of it was rocky, you know, but portions of it were very rocky, and they're still rocky today. And he took portions of it and just started to design it.
Nice.
And they were designing, and he was going, and he'd design something and didn't like it and look at it, and he'd crumple it up, throw it away, and start all over again.
Wow.
And this is 1858. You know?
That's amazing.
I don't even know if the pencils were invented back then, but anyway. But he had a vision, you know. He had a vision back then about making cities more livable and people-friendly. And cities in the 1800s were a miserable, dirty, polluted places to live. No sewage systems, no running water, no this, no that. I don't know how in the world they did it.
Or even
and people that complain today about pollution and this and that and all the little petty things that some are complaining about, gosh, go back 100 years or 150 years and see what the place was like then. We've vastly improved our living conditions over the last 150 years.
We got a phone call.
Okay, shoot.
All right. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Mike Winters.
Hi.
Hey, Mike. It's Jim Daniel. I wanted to tell you about a garden that was built about 100 years ago in Fresno, of all places.
Did you build
it? No.
I was just wondering.
I was just a toddler back then. Forrest Derry.
Yeah.
Now, Forrest Derry was the guy's name. He built an underground garden. And what he did, he had some land with this terrific hard pan. So he cut through it, and he dug tunnels underneath, and he put big round skylights in through the hard pan and put mostly citrus trees in there.
Huh.
Loved to graft citrus. He had one with about a dozen different kinds of citrus on one root. And just a kind of an intriguing idea. His original goal was to build a whole parking area and a restaurant underground where it wasn't so dang hot. Because, you know, Fresno, it's 112 in the shade, and they shade fast.
Right, yeah.
But it's really an intriguing place. You can take tours of it. It's about a mile off of Highway 99 down there in Fresno.
Huh.
And I've been through there several times, mostly as a kid with my parents.
Yeah.
But it's quite a place, quite an interesting story. Again, a wheelbarrow and a shovel pick, and he just did it.
Yeah. Were these like natural caves were there, or he just did it?
It was flat land with hard pan, and he dug through the hard pan to get below it.
Man.
Yeah.
Man, you know, and I think I got it hard, gee whiz.
Yeah, and, you know, there was no such thing as a power tool.
No, of course not.
And he just did it through grit and determination, and it's a kind of a pretty place, very unusual, very different.
How large is it, Jim? How large is it?
I want to say about 20 acres.
Jeez.
It's the, and they've got a website and everything, and it's worth taking a little detour off of 99 if you're going that way.
Yeah, I would. If I, now that I know about it, if I ever go back to California, I will stop.
Yeah, you and me both. But anyhow, yeah, it's worth a stop just to take a look and see what he accomplished. And it's still owned and operated by the family. Now it's just kind of a tourist site.
Huh.
But very intriguing. Yeah. Very intriguing.
Yeah, that is cool. And what's the actual name of it?
Forestieri, Forestierie, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Underground Gardens.
Okay.
And people refer to it as the Underground Garden in that area. Everybody knows about
sure,
it.
Sure.
But
that's great.
His name is, he's an Italian immigrant, just had an idea in his head, and they couldn't talk him out of it, I guess.
Good for him. Well, thank you, sir, for the call and the information. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks, Jim. All right. That was interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that.
You know, this thing seems to be cutting out.
Is it?
And, yeah, and I don't know why. but.
Well, we'll switch headphones during the break.
Okay. So, anyway.
Speaking of break, you want to do that?
Yeah,
now?
Let's do break before I get back to Central Park.
Okay.
We'll be back. Trust me.
Yes, we will. News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Oh, Dave Ramsey tells it like it is.
Oh, good old Dave, you know.
Yeah, we love him.
Him and what's the name? Aunt Matilda? Or?
Oh, Gladys. Aunt Gladys.
Yeah, love them both.
Anyway, back in New York.
Yeah, back to New York. And I want to thank Jim Daniels for that story about the Fresno Underground Gardens. I had never heard of it, and like I say, if I ever get to California again and near Fresno, I will make it a point to go see it. But back to old Frederick here, who was in the middle of designing this great park called Central Park on the island of Manhattan, surrounded by huge skyscrapers and all that. But he designed the entire park using the trees that existed. And then he added some trail systems and kind of wound trail systems through the place. Actually put some lawns in, but again, I don't know how they irrigated because the article didn't say anything about, said the lawns were water. Or it was, who knows. And then instead of all kinds of shrub beds and stuff, he just put small plantings of shrubs and flower gardens, you know, kind of spaced out around here. Here and there, and just to kind of, tie it all together. Then he built these small private areas with views into the cityscape, along with small footbridges over the natural waterways. And this made an interesting and beautiful park and right in the heart of the city. And like I say, he was, at that time, the city was, you know, pretty foul and ugly and smoky and dirty. And, you know, they didn't have what we have.
So what's new?
Yeah, exactly. And, but, you know, this is welcomed by the residents of Manhattan and has been a refuge for over 100 years. And Frederick and his team actually finished up their work in 1863. Now, they started in 1858 and finished in 1863. He had to have 100 people working for him or something to get 700-acre park or almost 800-acre park, online.
Yeah,
and ready
that's
to go.
Not a whole lot of time for that.
Yeah. then old Frederick says he went on a tour of America building parks at the age of 41. And he visited Yosemite and viewed it as a park for the whole nation. The article didn't say that he made any suggestions to the government about how they should manage Yosemite. But he had a really great vision for like all of America, and he went on to build parks in Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. And he also designed the grounds of the Capitol in Washington, D.C.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so, and he was also, he was also on the planning of Yosemite and Niagara Falls. I guess they called him in as a consultant of some sort. Hmm. And so he gave his 2 cents worth. And, I would have loved to have been on his team just to see what this guy was all about, with my current knowledge of landscaping and trees and all that, just go back in time and say, wow, how'd you do this, man?
Yeah.
Give me
some hints.
Give me some hints. How do you do that with an old wooden wheelbarrow and a horse-drawn buggy?
I was going to say, no transportation, basically.
Yeah. But old Frederick, his work was based on really careful, detailed planning. And that was the key to the success and the great beauty of the park in the long term. He had a real vision. He could see, he could see what it was all about. He had a vivid imagination to look at almost 800 acres of wild whatever with rocks all over it. Say, yeah, we can make this a park. This would be cool. We'll put some trails here and some view areas here, mm-hmm. some picnic areas here. And of course they've improved and added things over the years. I think they got tennis courts and baseball fields and all kinds of stuff in there now. Yeah. But it's still very
it's hard to see how they could make that work.
I know. I was trying to figure that out, and I'm thinking, how in the world did he do this?
With no communication.
Yeah, no cell phone, my gosh.
Yeah.
No fax. Oh,
can't do that.
Poor man. and some of his plans were rejected by the local planners in many cities. Hey, you couldn't do that here. But Fred was proud of his work, and he didn't bend to the boards and the committees who wanted him to do this and that. And he said, hey, forget it. You don't want me? Forget it. I did Central Park and the White House, but hey, don't worry.
That ain't good enough for you.
If that's not good enough, I'm hitting the road. I'm going to go to Roseburg. But, he just insisted on his artistic freedom, and and you got to do that sometimes with clients. I'll always approach a client here and say, well, what would you like to see? And they'll say, well, we want this, this, and this, and this, and this, and that. And I'm looking at, the space available, the ground available, the sunlight available, other structures that are near or far, or, how's it actually going to work for their vision? And most of the time, I have to modify that, and I say, well, how about this? Instead of doing three of those over there, we do the one there, and then we build this, and then we create this area over here, and there's a play area for the kids over here. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, geez. And this, and you have to verbalize it in such a way that they can get a picture.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing for folks that, like this computer stuff and me, we don't get along at all because I can't picture how this all works, so I just forget it. I don't do it. it's real simple.
Let somebody else do it.
Let somebody else that's smarter than me. I don't want to do it. But, but that's part of the job, is part of verbalizing and telling them, well, this won't work because your soil's too shallow, or you don't have enough room for that kind of a tree, or your slope's too steep, or there's a whole host of reasons. And once you explain that to folks, they catch on. I mean, there's one or two that are very adamant in what they want, and those are the ones that, I can't do that. It won't work. And if you insist on that, here's the name of somebody else that might be able to help you.
Right.
And shake hands and leave on good terms and all that. And it's okay. But artistic design and the freedom to design. And a lot of times when I draw a sketch for something, you know, just a rough sketch of what their yard could be, I tell them that. I says, now, we're just standing here, and I just sketched this out very quickly and named a few things, but you got to give me the leeway to change things up a little bit. You'll have, you know, better than what I scribbled on this piece of paper, because I'm standing with a notepad, just kind of freehand drawing. And yeah, go ahead. And most of the time, a lot of the times, I don't know about most, but a lot of the times when we're done with a job, the owner, the homeowner, the client will say, you know, this is so much more than I had envisioned.
Wow.
You know, I really love it. You know, we just got done with one this afternoon out in Melrose, I think, or yes, I guess it's still Melrose. And I'll pass the country club down that way. And at any rate, yesterday, one of the lady of the house had some questions about some of the plants that I was using or where I was placing them, and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And we talked, and I said, well, the reason we chose this is because you didn't like the big ones that were in here. Mm-hmm. And these are dwarf or semi-dwarf, so they're not going to be overwhelming, and they're not going to crowd out things. And yet you got color and all that. Well, today when the crew finished up, she was looking at it, and she just loved it. She said, nice. Oh, this is so beautiful. This that's is so cool. Much so much more than what I had envisioned. And that's what you need to have, is the ability to communicate to your client and stick to your guns when you know something will work or when something will not work in a particular situation. And that's how Frederick was. And, you know, I guess like Rembrandt and those guys, when they're doing their paintings and stuff, I'm sure they had a whole handful of critics there going, out. Oh, what's
sure.
that? Yeah, what's that stuff, man? Well, you should have used orange instead of purple.
Yeah, everybody's got an opinion.
Right, right. But when it's in your head and in your heart to do an excellent job, it comes out an excellent job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd be a very poor at what you do. You do excellent work with all those buttons. There's, what, 100 buttons there I'm looking at or more?
Probably.
Yeah. Don't tell me to run this thing. I couldn't do it, but you can.
Well.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you, but I can.
Well, you know, I'm amazed at all the skills that people have in the computer world. I really am. You know, this when you get that freedom to create, and you get that freedom to convince your client that, hey, this is going to look a lot better than what you thought or what you wanted to have in that particular area, you'll like it. And you know, 99 times out of 100, they love it. So that's good. And what helps is you got to have a working knowledge of plants,
right.
How they grow, what they need to live. The amount of sunlight, those kinds of things. And that's how we treat people that come into the nursery. They want to, you know, they're going to do their own landscaping, their own planting. Make sure, we may always make sure that don't plant these too close to the house or the driveway or the walkway or because they're going to get this size, blah, blah, blah. Don't put them too close. I remember one time a couple came in, they were wanting a hedge.
Yeah.
And they wanted Fotinia. That's a red-leafed shrub that, you know, people put along for screens, privacy screens and stuff. And they were at another competitor's place. They didn't say where. They said, well, we want 30 of them. I can't remember the exact number. And I said, well, how long of an area do you have? She says, well, it's about 70 feet or 75 feet. I said, well, 30 of them, you'd probably have them about 2.5 feet apart, and in about 3 years, it'd be a jungle in there.
Oh, wow.
And in 5 years, you'd be wanting to rip them all out because that's way too close. And they didn't know that. I said, this is how big these dudes grow. And, you know, they'll grow, you know, 7 or 8 feet wide easily. And if you don't ever prune them, they can grow 10, 12 feet easily.
Wow.
And if you just want a nice, neat screen in your backyard that's going to look good and do the job, you could probably, and they, you know, we're asking for 30. I said, you'd probably do this with about 10 or 12. She said, you're kidding me. I said, no, honest, really, for real life. I'm not kidding you.
Really, and I know what I speak.
I know, really. I know how these things grow. Trust me, lady.
Yeah.
Oh, but, you know, you need to know the size, the shape, the color, and, you know, the long-term stability of a plant when you're putting it in somebody's yard, because you don't want them calling you up in 5 years and say, I hate you. You put these plants in here.
I can't even see my house.
My house has been engulfed with vines and stuff. Help me.
What a mess.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So we got another break?
A couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, there was another lady way back when. Her name was Alice Eastwood. And she was big in the early days of plant.
I thought you meant she was large.
No, big. I mean, she was top of the list, well known. Yes. Yeah. Actually, I saw a picture of her. She was she was with her cane. She was in some wilderness area selecting plants, and she was 90 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
She loved her trade.
Oh yeah, she loved her job. But she started. I was in charge of the San Francisco Herbarium, which collects all kinds of exotic plants from everywhere. And this herbarium, herbarium, I think.
I think that sounds right.
Yeah, it sounds right. I hope it is. If I'm not, call me and correct me. but this is in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And the year is like 1906, right? And she's working there, and she's going to get ready to go to work, and she's coming down her stairs, and felt some shaking going on.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And what it was the 1906 San Francisco earthquake.
Oh, no.
Well, it totally destroyed herbarium. Thank you. And it left like 100,000 specimen plants in ruins, crushed it.
No.
The whole place fell down. But Alice's attitude was a real positive, and then she says, "I get to start this all over again. This is fun," you know. And that's what she said. That was a quote. You know, I did it before and I enjoyed it. I'm going to do it again and enjoy it. You know, and in her work, she collected plants from like Mount Shasta. She climbed Mount Shasta with a group of men, and it was.
Are you serious?
No, yeah, I'm serious. This is like in 1907 or something, you know. And they were collecting high elevation plants to bring back to the San Francisco Arboretum or whatever. She said, "This is the only time in my life that I wanted to be a man so I could wear pants," because of the ice and the snow and the cold. You know,
she couldn't wear pants just because.
Well, back in the day, they didn't do that. So.
Oh, okay.
They had these long dresses down to their toenails. Okay?
Wow, it seems odd to me.
You're one of the 2000 guy. We're talking 1907 or something, you know. But she was called the self-taught botanist, and she was very, very knowledgeable. And she impressed the San Francisco, California Academy of Sciences that they offered her the job to run in that whole herbarium, and she expanded the collection through her own efforts as she, she explored the Sierras, she explored the Coast Range for rare plants, and sometimes she was on horseback, because this is early 1900s, and often, just hiking around looking at it. But from 1912 until 1949, Alice added 340,000 specimens to the herbarium in San Francisco. So she was invited to Sweden then because her reputation was pretty
cool. Yeah, they heard about her.
Yeah, they heard about her. Who was this lady to get 340,000 strange plants?
Jeez.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's a lot of work for crying out loud. She was named the honorary president of the International Botanical Congress. And, high honor in the plant world, it's like being president of the world or something. And she was still collecting rare plants at the age of 90, and she did die when she was 90. It was like, whoa. So, anyway.
She must have been in good shape.
She was a skinny little gal.
Was she?
Yeah, and she had this big, long cane. I don't know if she needed the cane. It was like a walking stick.
Yeah.
And in the photo I saw of her, she's got this big old, the walking stick was as tall as she was, and she's looking at some plants on the ground on a slope, so she's climbing mountains and climbing slopes and doing all kinds of stuff, so.
Gotta hand it to her.
You got a break yet or not?
Yeah, we do.
Because I got two more stories or three more stories to go through.
All right, we better take a break.
Yeah, well, hurry up.
Press the button. All righty, we'll be right back. Mike Winter's Lawn and Garden Show on a blustery Wednesday afternoon.
Blustery.
On News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Well, good afternoon. It's 4:40 and still a little chilly, 49 degrees. We're back with Mike Winter's Lawn and Garden Show here on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Whoa, we're back already? I don't sound like I'm
back.
That
was a quick break.
Are you sure I'm back?
No, I hope so.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't seem like it, but okay.
Got any Aunt Gladys stories?
Aunt Gladys came and had coffee with me the other day.
Did she?
Yeah, she said she didn't like your smart aleck remarks about her, so I'm just relaying the message.
Okay, sorry.
Anyway, I'm talking, telling stories today. I'm not really talking about a whole lot of plant materials because it's still cold, wet, and windy and snowy, and I don't feel like it, okay? And there's plenty we're going to do here as soon as the weather starts to turn. But on the local level, I've had some great mentors that have really increased my knowledge of plants and how they're used and how they grow and all that kind of stuff. And the first one I wanted to tell you about was my botany and silviculture professor at UCC. Mr. Lee Hunt was his name, and he was the toughest professor I ever had in college.
Wow.
Not only did he write the textbook we had to use,
whoa,
but he added many hours of lecture and field work on top of all that. And he was a very demanding guy, and he was probably in his upper 70s at that time. Great shape, could walk up a tree sideways and not even slip. But he wrote the textbook, and we had to buy it, and that's what we had to study out of it. And he was real good.
It was definitely his class.
It was his class, and you were either going to learn something or you were going to run away screaming, one of the two. And I forget how many forestry students were in the class at the beginning, maybe 20, 25, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
But by the end of the first year, we were down about 15.
Is that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And he chased them away. I mean, they were either not interested or they were afraid of him. And he was a really nice guy. You know,
very, was he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very personal. But, man, you needed to know your stuff. And like I say, he added many, many hours of lecture time in the classroom. And also field work. We had to do a lab every Thursday. It was lab day. It was a 3-hour lab. And so
that's a long lab.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were out in the field either planting trees or identifying this and looking at how to improve the soil, why won't a particular tree grow here. He had a tree farm out by Winston area, and that was our laboratory. And it didn't matter if it was snowing. It didn't matter if it was pouring rain. He says, you guys get rain gear, we're going out on Thursday. We don't skip labs.
Yeah, we don't care.
And he was right there with us the whole time.
Oh, wow.
Instructing. And you'd be out there. And on a day like today, you'd be out there, and it might be snowing on you, but you still did the work. You still had to ask questions. You still had to and he would explain mm-hmm. why this was going on and this was going on, why this tree grew this way and why it was good for this area or not good for this area, because he did a lot of experimentation on his mm-hmm. own place. I guess that's where I get it from, because I do a lot
you
of it.
Do, yeah.
You know, I plant trees that aren't supposed to grow around here. Well, I plant them just to see if that's true.
Yeah.
And I found out that 99%
of
them
the time,
just go do it.
Yep.
They don't care
yeah.
what you say. You
a
know?
Little ground and water and
yeah,
let me go.
Give me some ground. Give me some water. But, you know, if it was 100 degrees, we were still out there doing our lab on Thursday.
Well, that's good for you.
Oh, yeah, it is. It cuts out the folks that aren't really, you know, 100%.
What do you call them, snowflakes?
Well, when it's snowing on you, do it. But we studied trees and shrubs from the inside out and from the top to the bottom. And when I say the inside out, there's a device called an increment borer.
Mm.
And you want to know the real age of a tree. It's a long steel, it's not a tube, but it's kind of a half a tube. And you screw it into the trunk of the tree, to about the center of the tree, and then you unscrew it back out, and then you get a cross section of the annual rings of the tree, and you count the annual rings that are in that half. I don't know what you call it, but it's like half a pipe, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually see the rings of the tree and determine, well, that's good growth on this site, or that's bad growth. Why isn't it doing a better job? So we had to do those kinds of things. We had classes on a mill acre plot is like a thousandth of an acre or something. And we had to do vegetation identification of weeds and all the other stuff in this thing that's, three 4 wide and 4 feet long. I forget what the heck the dimensions were.
Right.
But and it's snowing on you, and he's explaining this to you, and by golly, you better be listening, because it's going to be on the exam. And you better be taking notes. But
were there a lot of weeds and plants?
Yeah. We're talking forest. We're talking out in the woods. And, whatever growing naturally out there. And that's what he was trying to teach us, of all the natural vegetation is there competing with trees, and they're competing with this. And how does this all fit? How does this all work? And how could we improve it? Is there a way to improve it? Because he was always trying to look for trees and things that would improve the local timber industry, and trees that would grow on hot south slopes. A south facing slope, Doug fir really struggles to get a foothold in there, and they're usually not too successful growing on a south slope. Where on a north slope, where there's more shade, more moisture, and they grow gangbusters. They'll grow 2-3 feet, maybe 4 feet a year in ideal conditions.
South is too warm.
Because the way the sun swings, it's in the sun all day long from say April to first part of November, and it's the driest because of the evaporation from the soil. Whereas the opposite is the north slope, and it's shady. And there are certain species of trees, like Douglas fir, that grow very, very well on a north slope, and that's where you get your best growth for timber, et cetera. And there's more ferns and vine maple, dogwoods, a real combination of natural vegetation growing in there, where you won't find that on a south-facing slope. And then the east slope and a west slope. East slope gets shaded in the afternoon because the sun's gone by it. And the west slope is shady in the morning until the sun comes over, and then is shining directly on it for the afternoon until it sets. So, those are all parts of the whole forestry
equation
that you have to take into consideration. And that's what this guy was teaching us, and on his own 40 acre parcel, he grew Australian eucalyptus. to see if they would work here. And they did. There were some of the varieties that I've got some at the nursery now that I sell, that I use. I've got one that's been growing there for 15 years out front, and it provides wonderful shade. And
you might want to save it. They may need it for
The
fires down there.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that. But, it's every type. He grew every type of, fir and pine just to see if they'd grow in Douglas County. And like I say, the bottom line is if they did, they could be used in reforestation projects where the ground was tough. And those are the kinds of things that he was teaching us, and how to prep the soil, how to select the trees, how to plant them properly, what to look for, to give it as a the most ideal set of conditions you could without spending hours, to be very, very quickly. But I remember many labs planting these exotic tree species on south slopes and in snowstorms just to see if they'd grow in Douglas County. And I thought, what are we doing out here? And you got a lab partner. I don't know, man. That old guy's crazy. We're freezing to death, and he's just laughing and smiling and having a good time.
While you guys are whining and complaining.
And we're whining and complaining. I was 22 when I started college. But Lee Hunt was a great man and a very demanding teacher. And all of our exams were open book tests.
Oh, cool.
All of them.
Cool. I like those.
Not only and he encouraged us to work together in groups in answering the questions, and while we're taking the tests, and he would pass out the exam like on a Tuesday, and it wouldn't be due till the next Tuesday. He gave us a week to do our exams and said, yeah, I don't care. You can have 10 of you there looking up answers. And, you know, and I'll tell you, we did, because the questions were almost impossible to answer, because he didn't say that. Well, he'd write notes on the blackboard. When we come in the classroom, he'd have every blackboard in the classroom covered with notes.
Oh, wow.
And the words were small. I mean, he had information. And one of the first things you asked him, Mr. Hunt, do we have to copy all this down? He said, if you want to pass the class, you do. You know? I'll be asking you questions. So everybody took, well, those that really wanted to graduate with a forestry degree took copious notes, you know.
Wow.
But, and
tedious.
Here's the cool thing. Do we have a commercial?
Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay. Here, one of his, not one of his students, in 2 years that I was in his classes, ever scored 100% on a Lee Hunt exam. Mm. In the 2 years of his classes, I once got a 97%, and he and I argued about my answer, but he wouldn't change it. And he said he would show me the answer in the notes from 3 weeks earlier, and he did. He went through his notes and says, hey, there it is. I said, I wrote that down. He said, well, actually, you didn't observe it then. You didn't see it. It didn't sink in.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I deserve 100%. No, you don't. You missed that one. You got a 97.
We have names for those people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but he was such a good-natured man.
Yeah,
and he
yeah.
wanted you to learn.
Sure.
You know, he shared with you, and and there was stories, and you know, with every blackboard, you know, walk in there and all the blackboards got all this stuff on them. Plus, you got your textbook that he wrote, you know. You're going, geez, Louise, man. But we were required to, you know, take all those notes and keep them with the textbook and the end. But in the end, I did receive A's on my report card. On my and all of his classes.
All right.
You know, so he knew who was serious and who wasn't, and his, you know, his grading structure. I don't know. I never questioned him on it. I got an A. I didn't care. Give me 97 again. Who cares?
That'll work.
Okay. You going to a break?
We can if you're.
Yeah, go ahead. I got more stuff to talk to you about.
Okay. Couple of minutes, we'll be right back. Mike Winter's Lawn and Garden Show, live on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, we are back. We have a couple of more minutes left with Mike Winters today.
Yeah, and basically I've been telling stories about the people who have mentored me and the articles that I've read that I've deemed important to my avocation of landscape design and growing plants and things like that. And I just got finished with my silviculture botany professor at UCC many years ago a man by the name of Lee Hunt. And he was a taskmaster, to say the least, but he was a very fair taskmaster. And we ended up to be good friends afterwards, because I helped him on some tree projects and things a few years later, thinning trees at 5,000 feet so he could take these Shasta fir to California at Christmas time to sell them. The problem was, he didn't tell me this, when we got them all down in the mountain, because there was about 3 feet of snow we were going through to cut these stupid things. And we got them down the mountain. He said, oh, by the way, Mike, could you take these to Santa Maria, California for me? And I went, where? And he says, Santa Maria. It's down by, you know, past San Luis Obispo and all that country. And like a energetic young mentoree, I said, oh, surely I'll be able to do that, but I need some gas money. He said, not a problem. That's a different story. But here's the deal, the finishing touch on Lee Hunt. After I graduated from UCC, I had two forestry degrees, and one in recreation and one in technology. And my first forestry job was cruising timber for Roseburg BLM office. And I loved it, and I learned a lot. I worked with the two best cruisers at that time in the district, Denny Miller and John Kent. And boy, they knew their work, and they were taskmasters as well, but they were fun to work with, and they did teach me a lot. I mean, I knew the basics of it, but the speed by which they would work a stand of timber was incredible. They would walk almost at a normal speed, counting every tree, estimating its diameter and its height, and writing it in a book all the time while they were chatting and telling jokes to one another, walking through steep ground, and I'm trying to catch up with them and learn all this stuff. But it was a good thing. But here's the kicker. After several months on the job, Mr. Hunt called me and asked me, he says, would you be interested in a forestry research position with Oregon State University? I said, what? I was like, that's a dream job, you know? I mean, whoa, you know, working for OSU? Yeah, yeah. As a watershed research technician up in a place called Blue River, which is like 45 miles east of Eugene, up on the McKenzie. So he said, well, yeah, I said, I'll do it. So he called the university and gave him my name to interview, and they gave me a call, and I went first to Blue River on the Andrews Experimental Forest and spent 3 hours there being interviewed by the guy in charge at the forest. And then he says, oh, by the way, you got to go to Corvallis. They want to interview down there at Corvallis at the Forest Sciences Lab and the Pacific Northwest Range and Experiment Station office, which is all on the campus at OSU. So I went down there for another three-hour interview, and there were 11 candidates for the position altogether, and I was amazed, but they offered me the job, and all I can say is thanks to Lee Hunt, I had a new career in watershed management research, and for 2 years I worked up in Blue River on the Andrews Experimental Forest, helping scientists from all over the world, from Japan, from China, from Poland, from, you know, everywhere in their different experiments, and it was a very big education until I decided to be an entrepreneur and go on my own and go back to Roseburg where I had a house and a family. So
there you go. Seems, you know, like it worked out all right.
It worked out really great. I mean, but those people really helped me and pointed me in the right direction, and it was great. And I got more stories for next week, and then we'll get into the technical stuff.
All righty. It's 5 o'clock.
Bye.